Okay. Thanks very much, Viviana, and all of the organizers. I'm very happy to be here. I'm going to talk about the theoretical introduction of this book that a friend and colleague of mine, Kristen Chupa, at sociologist at the University of Regina, and myself put together. And Viviana and Ruth and Chris are in the room. They have chapters in the book as well. I'm just going to outline some of the theoretical premises of it, and if I have time, a bit of the details of chapters beyond. But it won't be much given the 15 minutes. So, basically, the main objective of the volume was to inaugurate a research agenda aimed at filling what we take to be an enormous gap in the literature on Latin American extractivism around labor, and then more particularly productive labor. And it tries to fill this gap partially, or introduce the need of filling it, by anatomizing productive labor within contemporary capitalist extraction in the region. And what we argue through a systematic survey of both the Spanish and Portuguese and English literature is that outside of agrarian extractivism, where this is partially an exception because of the way that the agrarian question was posed, the labor question has been almost invisible in the theoretical and empirical research into extractivism. Apart from social reproductive labor, which we'll talk about, even when it's not theorized as social reproductive labor. So the axiomatic premise of the book is that productive labor constitutes the quote-unquote heart of the matter of Latin American extractivism as the source of value under, because this is not any extractivism, but capitalist extractivism, and that it deserves more attention. I mean, that's the basic premise of the book. So we start off by distinguishing between labor in general, that is the transhistorical category of labor, and then productive labor and then social reproductive labor, so that we justify theoretically what we're doing. So labor in general, we follow Marx, who understood it to encompass all forms of creative, conscious, imaginative life activity as characteristic of our species being, right? Life activity that we engage in socially because we're social individuals, another aspect of our species being, but that we engage with and we appropriate aspects of biophysical non-human nature, of which we are part of nature, but we appropriate elements of non-human nature through that life activity, which is distinguishable from animals' relationship or other animals' or most other animals' relationship with non-human nature insofar as it is intentional, designed, conscious activity. And so there's no question that at this level of generality, there's no question of a politics of escaping labor, like an anti-labor politics in our view. Labor just characterizes social activity, life activity, which is conscious. So you can't avoid this, right? Nor can you avoid appropriating biophysical properties from nature. So the question is also not avoiding extractivism in some kind of generic sense of extracting biophysical resources, because we wouldn't exist as a species without either of these two components, right? So the issue is establishing a non-alienated form of labor and a non-alienated form of relationship with the non-human aspects of nature. We then move to the question of inside of that, we point out that starting with labor is makes sense for that basic reason as a problem, but rather than starting anywhere else in the study of the sociological and political and economic forms that we assume in different periods. That's the justification for starting there, but also the sense in which the way in which you organize socially that kind of life activity And the way that you organize the social arrangements that relate you to that necessary biophysical appropriation of aspects of non-human nature has enormous consequences for the level of freedom and equality in the forms of labor that are necessary, right? So those are basic axiomatic premises, but we think they're necessary, not least because of the problems in the existing, some of the problems in the existing literature. But we then move to the point of the book, which is less that as an intervention than the focus on productive labor. So the analytical remit of the book in terms of a intervention is to focus exclusively on capitalistically productive labor in export production complexes of contemporary Latin America. So what does that mean? First of all, many contributors in the book don't agree with us in the introduction. So they do different things, which is to be invited. But the theoretical premise in the intro is what I'm talking about, right? So I'm just speaking for myself and Kristen. By productive labor, we refer to labor that directly creates value in the Marxist sense. That is labor which produces value that can be measured economically from the standpoint of capital. Where value is the surplus or extra that returns to capital beyond its expenditure. It is, in other words, the growth of capital after accounting for all expenditure in production. So the surplus or extra in question is directly traceable to workers and productive workers in this sense. So the worker produces more value than is needed for the reproduction of their own labor power because they work in excess of the time it takes to create that value. So it's a basic, this is hardly an innovation of ours, right? But this is to identify productive labor in the specific sense that we're talking about. So in light of competition with other capitals, the capitalist is driven to expand their business and to reduce the labor time necessary for the worker's subsistence and increase the rate of exploitation, that is that surplus or extra that they're extracting. Within the logic of the capitalist system, the entire driving force behind production is the necessity of expanding capitalist value, that is the increase or valorization of capital itself. So value is created through the production of goods and services for exchange on the market, that is when the product of labor is destined for sale in the market as a commodity, right? Immediately, directly, in our sense. So not in an indirect form, which would various other arguments around this matter take. So for example, rearing a child, ultimately that child under capitalist society will become, their labor power will be commodified. But you are not engaging in reproductive labor in the family unit. You're not directly producing a commodity for sale on the market. In our view, not in everyone's view, including people in the edited volume, right? But at a minimum, ours has the benefit of saying what we think, and then you can disagree. So social reproductive labor for us. So productive labor is distinguishable from not-for-profit. Social reproductive labor, paid or unpaid, which is explicitly not labor set in motion to produce a commodity for sale on the market. So social reproductive labor is the work involved in maintaining and reproducing human life. So under capitalism, most of this labor has been performed, obviously I'm making huge general statements in the interest of 15 minutes, by women in the family unit, but portions of this in different social and historical and geographical contexts have been performed by things like the welfare state, often in response to the level of weakness or strength of feminist movements explicitly organizing around these questions, right? So it's important to emphasize right away that when we're talking about the focus on productive labor, this isn't a political or moral or analytical claim to the exclusivity of productive labor as the only thing you need to understand for extractive labor. So we recognize explicitly that a full account of labor in any capitalist situation needs to think about the entire reproduction of capitalism, which involves both of these forms of labor, as well as both of them being part of labor in general, all of this socially organized, intentional life activity. But the point that we're trying to make is that every volume can't and shouldn't try to achieve everything, and this focus on productive labor, directly productive of value, is enormously missing in the literature around, which is quite distinct from earlier literatures, as we tried to revisit those. So we think that and we use a metaphor that Cynthia Arruza uses in her remarks on gender in this very important essay, where there she talks about productive labor being an analogy of thinking about productive labor as the heart of capitalism, right? Now, the point there is to say that is not that you can that you ought to anatomize the heart, and there should be some people who are experts in the heart, but to understand the heart as distinguishable from the organic entity of the body, as if you could understand the heart separable from these other elements, is obviously a non-starter, right? When you think about it in that sense, but there is a purpose, not just heuristic, to the relative autonomy of the different elements and thinking about their functions, not as separable, but as internally related with these other aspects, and not just thinking about the interconnectedness of the different aspects, but to thinking about the relative autonomy of each function. Right. So this is the claim that says it's purposeful and useful to have a focus on productive labor, and it doesn't tie you to a claim that you've done everything or that you've had the full picture of the labor struggle. There's also a question, finally, of structural power, the direct structural power of export complex production workers, which are not just the people immediately extracting goods, but also the transport sector attached to that and so on. insofar as those economies in Latin America, and obviously it's very different in different countries that you're talking about, but in those places where you have a concentrated So for example, the major source of foreign exchange might be massively tied to oil or massively tied to particular mining minerals or to soy or whatever, the commodity in question. The capacity to shut off that source of a foreign exchange is an incomparable structural power, right? So when the tin miners struck in Bolivia in the 20th century prior to their destruction in the mid-80s, they only ever represented 10% of the economically active population. And yet, when they went on strike, it was very unlike other sections of the labor force going on strike. It was very unlike any aspect of Bolivian labor striking or taking part in other activities. So something enormous is lost when we think about the question of labor and extractivism without thinking about the strategic importance, which is not to claim that even that power, even that structural potentiality, might only be realizable and probably is only realizable in alliance with all kinds of other struggles and so on, which you can't predict. It's simply to make that point. There's kind of no way even to get to the central point, which I'm trying to get. So the second influence here is Fernando Coronel. I'll go just very briefly on this point. It deserves a lot bigger discussion, but he's trying to introduce what he calls or reintroduce, because he thinks that this ties him more closely to Marx himself, what he calls a triadic dialectic, which at the time of his writing, so the book is called The Magical State, and the triadic dialectic is to take seriously the interrelationship between capital, land, and labor, with land understood, as Marx did, as more or less non-human nature, not land in a strictly agricultural sense, although it includes that. And the point he was talking about, he was responding at his time to what he saw as a closed dyad of capital labor that had overcome Marxism, without understanding that although non-human nature, land, doesn't produce value, only human labor produces value, it does produce, it is a source of material wealth and without which you can't understand rent, which is very important to understand in the extractive sectors of Latin America. Let's put that crude point there. But what we identify is not Coronel's problem, because Coronel's problem is distinct from our problem today. There is to the extent that anyone uses dialectics in extractivism, which is vanishingly rare as a theoretical premise, but to the extent that it's there implicitly, the dyad is rather capital nature. So capital nature is capital or capital land. So the struggles are around dispossession, around which are very important struggles. The point is not to marginalize that focus, but it misses in a different way the open triadic character of these components in a way that's unhelpful. So we're trying to reintroduce this. The final point that we bring in, and it plays a much bigger role than I made it seem like in my misorganization of time, is the Charles Burkis, we return to Charles Burkis' seminal book with the unsexy title of just 2 minutes on Burkis. The Labor in Latin America, and then essays on Venezuela, Colombia, Argentina, and Chile, which has gone out of print. And a side project involved with this is that the historian Forrest Hilton and I are editing a reissue of that with Verso that's coming out. So it will hopefully renew a project. But that book, which is focuses explicitly on the idea that the export production complex, the workers involved in it, were fundamentally determining of national political and economic trajectories, divergent trajectories of different Latin American societies. And I'll just say on this point, he has seven different variables of importance, but one stands above the other, and that is Burkis singles out the capital requirements of export production as the most important. He has all these other dynamics, which we go into, where the high capital necessities of foreign capital tended to be advantage over national capital to assert control over the means of production. In such scenarios, capitalist relations of production were more likely to prevail over pre-capitalist ones, as were concentrated rather than dispersed units of production. And this becomes very important. So within this theoretical backdrop, two polar tendencies can be identified, and actually existing Latin American societies can be plotted on a continuum between them. On the one hand, you have extractive sectors with foreign ownership and concentrated production tending to privilege culturally autonomous, class-conscious, and anti-capitalist labor organization. He's interested in the late 19th century to basically the 70s. Among export workers, while simultaneously weakening prospects for economic development as a whole. So the strength of that limits the capacity to accumulate capital. So it generates developmental contradictions. And on the other hand, national ownership, low capital necessities, and diffuse production units tend to be an obstacle for labor organization in the export sector and anti-capitalist alliances more broadly, and thus improve the potentiality of overall economic development. So he looks from the late 19th century period of industrial capitalist development, the very beginnings of it in the region, to, as I say, the 60s and 70s, depending on the case. And he looks at Chile as the most radical, according to his metrics. Next up, Venezuela, which is still on the radical continuum of oil workers in the early 20th century. And then you move rightward to Colombia and then to Argentina, which is contested by our esteemed contributors. Okay, so what we try to do, and this is my last point in 30 seconds, what we try to do in the book is first off revisit Burkis' framework, again, not uncritically or as though you could mechanically adapt it to the present, but we tried to take into account the obvious transformations of capitalism even since he wrote the book, but even more so since the period that he's interested in, since the 70s. But extractivism clearly hasn't gone away. If anything, it's more important as a dynamic, and yet the study of productive workers and export complexes had gone away. So it makes sense in this way to revisit Burkis critically, and we look at the countries he looked at, all of the cases, from different angles, but we look at them mainly in terms of what happened since the 70s. And then we look at extending his project to new cases, so just new national cases that he never considered, although he had brief remarks about them. And then we think about new areas in which what he never considered, but elements of his theory might be usable for that. And Chris is one example of that innovative sort of inversion of Burkis' framework. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much.